Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello. When John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough, died in 1722, the satirist Jonathan Swift wrote a poem which he titled A Satirical Elegy on the Death of a Late Famous General. It goes like this. His grace, impossible. What, dead? Of old age too and in his bed? And could that mighty warrior fall, and so inglorious after all? Well, since he's gone, no matter how, the last loud trump must wake him now. And trust me, as the noise grows stronger, he'd wish to sleep a little longer. And could he be indeed so old as by the newspapers we're told? 80, I think, is pretty high. 'Twas time in conscience he should die. This world he cumbered long enough, he burnt his candle to the snuff. And that's the reason some folks think he left behind so great a stink. Though in truth, Swift writes S-K. Behold, his funeral appears, nor widow's sighs, nor orphan's tears. Want at such times each heart to pierce, attend the progress of his hearse. But what of that, his friends may say, he had those honours in his day. True to his profit and his pride, he made them weep before he died. Come hither, all ye empty things, ye bubbles raised by breath of kings, who float upon the tide of state, come hither and behold your fate. Let pride be taught by this rebuke, how very mean a thing's a duke, from all his ill-got honours flung, turned to that dirt from which he sprung. Now, while it not be so skillful to write disparagingly about somebody who's died, and especially someone who may not have lived a very wholesome life, Swift, in his poem, makes the point that we've been discussing at some length in our previous programs. Remember, we've been talking about death and how neither our possessions nor our friends nor our body can help us when the time comes to give up this mortal coil. No matter how much wealth and fame we've accumulated through our life, we have to leave it all behind at death time. In fact, whatever we have gathered and collected in this life is all wasted at death. John Churchill, Duke of Marlborough, might have been a great man in his day and very famous, but in the end, he could only serve as a reminder of the fate of all of us, rich or poor, famous or infamous. As Swift writes, "Come hither, all ye empty things, ye bubbles raised by breath of kings, who float upon the tide of state, come hither and behold your fate. Let pride be taught by this rebuke, how very mean a thing's a duke, from all his ill-got honours flung, turned to that dirt from whence he sprung." It also seems from what Swift says that the Duke wasn't always the kindest or most humble person around, and so he may not be facing a pleasant afterlife. Swift writes, "Well, since he's gone, no matter how, the last loud trump must wake him now, and trust me, as the noise grows stronger, he'd wish to sleep a little longer," suggesting that the Duke's soul would not want to face the judgment heralded by that last trump. In contrast, we ended last week's program with Thich Nhat Hanh's telling of the story of Anatta Pandika, who had devoted his life to spiritual practice, the Buddha and his community. You may remember that as Anatta Pandika lay dying and in considerable pain, the monk Shariputra and Ananda visited him and comforted him with guided meditations, culminating with the meditation on the ultimate state, which Thich Nhat Hanh characterized like this. "Everything that is has the nature not to be born and not to die, no birth and no death, not to arrive and not to depart, no coming, no going. When the body arises, it arises. It does not come from anywhere. When the body ceases, it ceases. It does not go anywhere. The body is not non-existent before it arises. The body is not existent after it arises. It's not because of the manifestation of the body that you can perceive the body and you think that the body is. It's not because you cannot perceive the body that you can qualify it as non-being. When conditions are sufficient, there is a manifestation. And if you perceive that manifestation, you qualify it as being. If conditions are no longer sufficient, you cannot perceive it, and you qualify it as non-being. And you are caught in these two notions. The ultimate dimension of our reality cannot be expressed in terms of being and non-being, birth and death, coming and going. And he went on to say that we have to be completely free of notions, even the notion we have of nirvana. This meditation had a profound effect on Anatta Pandika, which Thich Nhat Hanh describes like this. Anatta Pandika was a very able practitioner. When he practiced to this point, he was so moved that he got insight right away. He was able to touch the dimension of no birth and no death. He was released from the idea that he is this body. He released the notions of birth and death, the notions of being and non-being, and suddenly he got the non-fear. The Venerable Ananda saw him crying because of happiness, because of that kind of release. But Ananda did not understand what was really happening with a layperson, Anatta Pandika. So he said, "Why, dear friend, why are you crying? Do you regret something? Or did you fail in your practice of the meditation?" He was very concerned. But Anatta Pandika said, "Lord Ananda, I don't regret anything. I practiced very successfully." Then Ananda asked, "Why are you crying then?" Anatta Pandika said, "Venerable Ananda, I cry because I'm so moved. I've served the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha for more than 30 years, and yet I've not received any teaching that is deep like today. I'm so happy to have received and practiced this teaching." Thich Nhat Hanh says that the sutra reports that not long after the departure of the two monks, the layman Anatta Pandika died peacefully and happy. Now, I haven't heard of anybody writing a satirical poem on the death of Anatta Pandika, and I would think it very unlikely anybody did. Compare his life, in which the city folk fondly gave him the name Anatta Pandika, meaning the one who looks after the isolated ones, the unhappy ones, with the life of the famous general, whose epitaph is a poem with the lines, "That's why some folks think he left behind so great a stink." So this shows why it's a good idea to think well about death now while we're alive and capable. Are we concentrating on what will help us at death time and beyond? Or are we only concerned with the things that make this life enjoyable for ourselves? The teachings tell us that it's vital to think on impermanence and death if we really want to make life meaningful. And that is why this topic is considered one of the preliminary contemplations in any Dharma meditation practice, and why the author Namkar Pel includes it in the text we've been following, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. But now, before we go any further, let's consider our motivation for the program as we usually do. Once again, please, if you haven't done so already, develop a bodhicitta motivation to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Then the positive potential will be great, and the result of our cooperation today will also be very great. Thank you. Impermanence and death, which we've now completed, is the second preliminary in the Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun text. And then the text moves on to the third, that is consideration of actions and their consequences. It reads, "After death, we do not cease to exist, but have to take rebirth. Our place of birth will be either happy or miserable, according to our actions, rather than our free will. Therefore, it is reasonable to try to cultivate good actions properly and avoid bad ones." This is, of course, talking about karma, that part of the law of cause and effect that involves an intentional agent, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama defines it. In his book, Path to Enlightenment in Tibetan Buddhism, Geshe Lodin writes, "Strictly, the term karma means action. Its general usage, however, covers actions, the imprint made on the mind from actions motivated by delusion, and the results of those actions. The imprint is what links an action to its eventual result at some time in the future. The law of karma is therefore the law of cause and effect, and refers to the inevitable production of a certain future result by any action. An understanding of karma is the key to creating whatever future result you may wish to experience, whether it be achievement of higher status, wealth, beauty, or yet again the greater goal of definite goodness. All will be gained by knowing the correct causes for its production, that is, by understanding karma. Without such knowledge, any good conditions that you may experience are both temporary and unstable. You have no real knowledge how happiness and good conditions were produced, and therefore how to sustain and improve them. You remain bound by karma, but are unable to establish your destiny by controlling karma. Now, usually the teachings on karma include the four characteristics of karma, and Namkarpel's text is no different. The first is the certainty of actions and the results. The text says, "All instances of happiness or suffering, whether coarse or subtle, are the result of specific wholesome and unwholesome actions." And it quotes Nagarjuna's precious garland. All sufferings are the result of unwholesome actions. So likewise are all bad rebirths. The pleasure enjoyed throughout our lives and all happy rebirths are the result of virtue. Geshe Loden explains further, karma is certain in that positive karma will certainly bring the result of some form of happiness, and negative karma will bring the negative result of some form of suffering. This is definite. It is not possible for even the slightest happiness to be the result of negative actions, nor the tiniest suffering to be the result of positive actions. Karma generated by such virtuous minds as love, compassion, patience, and generosity will only bring happiness and never be the source of suffering. Conversely, karma generated by such negative minds as anger, attachment, jealousy, and pride will always result in suffering and can never provide even the slightest happiness. All good conditions, wealth, health, beauty, and happiness are experienced only in accordance with having created the positive karma that is their cause. Any sickness, pain, tension, fear, and suffering, even a moment of suffering in a dream, has negative karma as its invariable source. Plant a rice seed, and the crop must be rice, not barley or pomegranate. Plant a positive action, and its fruit must be happiness, never suffering. He goes on to say that we can pray as much as we like to whomsoever we like, but if we haven't created the cause for happiness, we'll not be able to experience it. He goes on to say that if we want to be beautiful, we should practice patience. If we practice anger, we create the cause for ugliness. Now this makes sense, even in our everyday world. Think about it. People like being around someone who's always patient and kind and hardly ever gets angry. As such a person might not be physically beautiful, but they are beautiful in the sense that it's always pleasant to be around them. One feels safe. However, someone who's always griping or angry is the opposite. Who wants to be around anyone like that? And when you think what an angry person looks like, with glaring eyes, snarling mouth, a red face, and giving out this violent vibe, do you really want to be anywhere near them? Imagine habituating yourself to anger and looking like that a lot of the time. And surely your face will start to hold on to that uptight, malevolent look, and you will become really unpleasant to look at, even at the best of times. As Renuka Singh writes in Becoming Buddha, Wisdom Culture for a Meaningful Life, when anger enters a beautiful face, no amount of makeup can hide the complete ugliness that manifests. You can see anger in people's faces. You can recognize it. You become afraid of anger just by looking at the terrifying face of an angry person. And that is a reflection of anger. It's a very bad vibration to give off. It makes everybody unhappy. Geshe Loden goes on, Some people whom we encounter have a presence that makes others feel relaxed and comfortable in their company. This is a result of positive karma, in particular, the actions of patience and respect and never harming others. Such people feel happy in themselves and naturally cause others to feel happy as well. There are others who are very difficult to communicate with at all. They project a harsh, negative feeling and carry a history of doing unpleasant things to others. This is a result of their negative karma. Through actions performed out of hatred, ill will, jealousy, and so on, they remain uncomfortable within themselves and cause others to be unhappy as well. Whatever your situation, good or bad, it is definitely the result of karma with a similar good or bad nature. He goes on to tell a story I've used before in these programs of a monk named Nyanpa Sangden with a very beautiful chanting voice. When he chanted prayers, passers-by were captivated by his glorious voice and would stop and listen outside the temple, Geshe Loden writes. Even wild animals would gather nearby when Nyanpa Sangden was chanting. On one occasion, the king and queen came by the temple and heard his voice. They were overcome by the beauty of the voice and went inside and asked the Buddha if they could meet this wonderful person. The Buddha told the king and queen that perhaps it was best not to disturb the monk, but they insisted, and so the Buddha allowed them into the chanting hall. When the royal couple saw Nyanpa Sangden, they nearly died of shock. The owner of the most beautiful voice they'd ever heard was the ugliest person they'd ever laid eyes on or could imagine. They felt sick to the stomach and asked the Buddha how this could be so. The Buddha explained that it was the certain result of karma. The monk in a previous life was a laborer helping to construct an extremely large stupa, a very holy monument symbolizing the enlightened mind. During the enormous project, Nyanpa Sangden became discouraged and openly criticized the stupa. He told the sponsor that he was completely crazy to have initiated such an impossible task. Later on, however, as the stupa neared completion, he saw the error of his criticism, and by way of atonement, offered a beautiful-sounding bell to adorn the top of the stupa. The Buddha explained to the royal couple that this illustrated the certain nature of karma. It was Nyanpa Sangden's angry criticism that caused his extreme ugliness, whereas the karma from offering the bell ripened as his glorious voice. Now, the second characteristic of karma is its multiplying nature. Nam Kaupel writes, a small wholesome or unwholesome cause can give rise to a much greater happy or miserable result. He quotes the text, Special Verses Collected by Topic, which says, performing even the smallest misdeed will lead to great fear and trouble in future lives, like poison that has entered the body. Creating even a small meritorious act will bring forth great joy in future lives and fulfill great purpose, like grain ripening into a bumper crop. Other verses from the same text say, just as the shadow of the bird accompanies it in the sky, so beings follow after wholesome and unwholesome actions. Just as the traveler with few provisions will suffer on the road, so sentient beings who do not do good will come to a bad end. Just as a traveler with plentiful provisions will have an enjoyable journey, so sentient beings who have done good will go to happy rebirth. And he quotes further, we should not do even the smallest wrong, thinking it would do no harm, for the accumulation of drops of water will gradually fill a large vessel. And don't think the little wrongs I've done will make no difference later, for just as single water drops gradually fill a large vessel, so ordinary things become filled with wrongs, collected little by little. Don't think the little virtues I've done will make no difference later, for just as single water drops gradually fill a large vessel, so the steadfast are filled with virtue, collected little by little. Geshe Loden says in his text, The Path to Enlightenment in Tibetan Buddhism, that a great result can come from a small cause because the energy of karma increases continuously unless we apply an opposing force. He likens it to an acorn, which can in due course become a huge oak tree with many branches and countless leaves, and of course, thousands of other acorns. It tells the story of Shakyamuni Buddha in his previous life as a boy offering a few sesame seeds to the Buddha of that age. After many eons, that action resulted in the boy being born as a universal king. Geshe Loden also tells of a monk who criticized his friends by calling them monkeys. For 500 lifetimes, he had to be born as a monkey as a result. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his commentary, makes the point that if something is helpful in the long run, but harmful in the immediate circumstances, it is worth doing. This is because we need to think in terms of long-term effects, he says. But if something is only helpful in the short run, but harmful in the long run, then it is something we may not do. Of course, there's no need to mention if something is harmful both in the long and in the short run. Think of killing either an animal out of desire for its meat or an enemy out of anger. In the short run, we'll feel relief and might find a fleeting rush of happiness. But in the long run, we may have to face the consequences of murder. So it will definitely bring a great deal of unhappiness and suffering. On the other hand, if we protect and save the life of some creature that is going to be killed, this only brings happiness as a result, in the long and the short term. From a small seed, a large tree grows, and likewise, from a small action, great results can come. So it's very true that a great happiness or suffering can come from small causes. And thus spake His Holiness. So even if we create a small negative action, we would do well to purify it as soon as possible. Now, if you were with us in previous programs, you will have heard of the four opponent powers: regret, reliance, remedy, and promise. Briefly, on committing a negative action, we realize it will bring suffering and regret having done it. Then reliance means essentially restoring the relationship we have harmed with our action. The action either harms other sentient beings or dismays the great beings, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so on. To restore our relationship with these great beings, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And to restore our relationship with other beings, we generate the minds of loving kindness, compassion, or, in best, bodhicitta. The remedy is a positive action that counters the negative action. It can be any positive action, but examples are reciting sutras, saving lives, meditating on the nature of reality, and so on. And then the fourth power, the power of promise, is to promise we will not do that negative action again for as long as we think we can keep the promise. It could be just for a short time if the action is irresistible, or it could be for life. So those are the four opponent powers we can use any time we find we've done something that we really should not have done, and which will have negative consequences for us. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his commentary, says that there are several opponent forces we can apply, different methods, to avoid having to experience the results of our negative actions. We can do constructive acts as opponents, he says. These are things we build up gradually, not just spectacular actions of giving our body away and things like that. As it says in Engaging in Bodhisattva's Behavior, we have to start in a low-key fashion and build up to more extensive acts. So we needn't get discouraged when we read about the acts of the great spiritual heroes, the bodhisattvas, who gave their bodies away and so forth. We can think how they started out, just like us, by doing small types of positive actions. The same thing goes for giving up our destructive actions and distorted habits. We start out small and work up to it by ridding ourselves of bad habits slowly. Then the next characteristic of karma is that we will not face any consequences of actions we have not done. Geshe Loden writes, "If the cause is not being created, the result will not be experienced. There is no effect without cause, no result without its causal action. An aeroplane crashes and all but one of its passengers are killed. That one person did not carry the karma to be killed at that time, whereas the others did. Soldiers at war can be wounded severely, but recover and remain alive for years. Other soldiers' wounds are not so severe, yet they die quickly. You may be surrounded by all manner of bad conditions and dangers, but if you do not carry the cause to be affected by them, a negative result will not be experienced. For example, some doctors and nurses are surrounded by people with the flu or various other diseases, but remain well themselves. Whereas other people maintain the right diet, do the right exercise, but still pick up any bug at any time. He goes on to say that we can see how karma operates if we just compare what happens to people who want to succeed in the worldly life. Some people put enormous effort into becoming wealthy, he writes. They study to improve their qualifications, work extra jobs, start businesses, renovate their houses, and try everything they can to get rich, but somehow continue to struggle financially. The problem is not lack of aspiration or effort. It is that they have not created the karma for the success that they desire. They're going about it the wrong way. Others seem to get whatever they want without effort. Their business soars, their career flourishes, their investments are timely and successful, and they receive pleasant gifts without ever having to ask. They've accumulated the karma to make this possible. Understanding karma allows you to achieve whatever it is you want by knowing its causes and accumulating them. Within the same family, each child may have totally different experiences in life because of his individual karma. One may be happy and relaxed, another miserable and tense. One may have continuous problems, while another child of the same parents has effortless success. At a group level, it is the same. The group karma of countries is such that everyone is able to eat, even be relatively wealthy, whereas others, such as Somalia, could not even dream of such a lifestyle. Underdeveloped countries try everything to improve, but without success, due to their unfortunate group karma. Everything depends on whether or not we have created the causes. Then the final characteristic of karma is that once an action is committed, the result will not ever fade. It can be influenced by a counteraction, but even if hundreds of eons go by, it will not just fade away and disappear. It will have to be experienced sometime. Namkapel quotes the King of Meditative Stabilization Sutra, which says, "It is impossible not to encounter the results of your deeds, but you won't feel the results of those done by others." And he also quotes from the Transmission of Discipline, "Even after hundreds of eons, actions are not exhausted. If they meet with their assembled conditions, then embodied beings will meet with their results." His Holiness comments, "Unless something happens to completely devastate the force of what we've built up, when the circumstances are around and gathered, the potential we have accumulated will ripen as we've collected it. The present external circumstances of the Tibetans losing their country correspond to inner causes. A long accumulation of destructive actions has caused us to lose our country, live in exile, and experience hardships. Take the situation in Africa, with a tremendous drought and famine that has been going on, or millions of people infected with and dying from a virus. This has to do with worldwide karmic patterns, which come from various forces in the mental continuums of various humans. Of course, we should include animals, but primarily it rests on potentials in human mental continuums that belong in the category of shared karma or general karma. These bring about changes in world karma and cause events like the tremendous droughts and famine in Africa. Even in such situations where there is large-scale disaster, we find that there are some individuals who survive and don't have a tremendous amount of difficulty, and this comes from their own individual potentials and karma. So when we experience terrible situations, we need to think how this is coming as a result of things we've done in the past, potentials we've built up. When we think this way, our mind can be a little more relaxed, less uptight and disturbed by the difficult situation we might find ourselves in. And with that, our time is up. Thanks for being with the program today, and I hope, as always, that you'll join us again next week. Please dedicate, as usual, to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Goodbye.